I want to show you something. How would you like to be asked to translate that? Let's try the other camera. It's better. Get in close so they can hear it on FM. Come on, Peter, you can't read that fast. Just hold your camera down. How would you like to translate that, folks? Now, that's cuneiform. And yet we are looking at cuneiform writings. Some of which were never known to exist, and which could not be read until the digs of the 1800s began to uncover it. And this happens to be some stuff that was uncovered at Ebla, some of it as late as 1975. Yet that is, I mean, one of the major problems that was faced in trying to decipher these writings was which way to read them. And which way are you supposed to be going to translate them? I'll give you some more pictures. I mean, I think this is fascinating reading. You want to read that? Somebody ought to sneak out to these airport toilets and put some of this on the wall. It drives some of those goonies absolutely out of their mind. I want to show you something else. Can I show you something else? Now, I wanted to show you that's problem number one. But once you figure out which way it's going and what the words are, then try this on for size. I just found this. This is very important. This is extremely important. Yeah, there it is. What's that page marker doing there? Now, here's some more of this. Take a look at that, and then I'm going to talk to you about it. You want to figure all that out? That happens to be a hieroglyphic Hittite sacrifice formula translated by H.T. Bossert in 1953 on the basis of the Phoenician Hittite bilingual found at Kara Tepe. Now, that's the archaeological find of a century is when you find a bilingual. And the Rosetta Stone enabled them to suddenly begin to interpret things. The Lion Stone. Now, they found a bilingual that enabled them to start figuring out the hieroglyphic Hittite writings because they could link it up with a bilingual expression in Phoenician. Now, this sacrifice formula is right here. Don't make a sacrifice a la Hittite unless you follow this formula. Now, you got 30 seconds figured out. Don't anybody get mad at me about blue and red hats anymore. But I want to add a problem. Once you figure out which way it's going, what the symbols might mean, the lion stone that was dug up had four columns of text. Now, we're talking about the final breakthrough in the Hittite uncovering, and we're talking about an empire nobody knew existed. Nobody at all. Until the turn of the century began to uncover. We're talking about 1930 and later when they began to uncover. They'd uncovered it sooner, but began to decipher these things. At Kara Tepe, Four columns of text were on a statue, the Lion Stone. John Frederick of Berlin was the first to send a translation out. The written passages were full of gaps. They constituted the longest Old Phoenician running text that had so far been discovered. And they also held the probability that hieroglyphics were a Hittite version of the same text. And they hadn't yet figured out it was a bilingual. But they go on and say, we learn that the author of the inscription was a king whose name in the vowelless Semitic script was written, and we'll use English letters. But here's the way his name was written. These are the only letters they had to go on. Now, once they've deciphered from hieroglyphics to these letters, that is all they had, because there are no vowels in the language, like ancient Hebrew. The author of the whole script, they were finally able to deduce through many, many sources and bilingual sources, here's what his name is. That's what that says. Asitawandas. From the 4ZTWD, for you that are listening on radio. The cuneiform script, ultimately being translated through bilingual sources, go back to it, and the Phoenician counterpart enabled them to determine that when that set of hieroglyphics that could translate out to ZTWD was found, it was the name of the king, Asitawandas, A-S-I-T-A-W-A-N-D-A-S. Now multiply that by hundreds and hundreds of words, and you will begin to understand why, as we're researching some of the names on foreign inscriptions of these lost tribes of Israel, you find why their name just sort of matriculates through various languages. The Assyrians conquer them. The Assyrians conquer a kingdom that split off under Jeroboam from the tribes of Israel that were united under David and under Saul. And those 10 tribes, by the 6th king, have a new capital at Samaria, and the 6th king's name was Omri, pronounced with a harsh aspirate. As it's anglicized, it comes over without the aspirate guttural GH or KH sound in front of it. Now in the Greek, for example, we know to put in front of a word written down in the Greek, we know to spell it with an H. Because now we'll put the little aspirate harsh sound in front of it that makes us put, when we write it in English letters, an H in front of it, Hagios, because the curved sound in front of it is our clue to pronounce it with a harsh aspirate sound, Hagios. If it were written like this, we'd pronounce it agios, and coming over into the English, it would be agios with no H in front of it. This little clue put in above the word now tells us whether the same letter is with a harsh sound or with the guttural aspirate sound left off. And if this little sign is there, we now pronounce it in English as H. But in the oldest records, they didn't have these things. You had to pick up on it some other way. So the name Omri would be written down without some clue that it had to have the guttural sound in front of it, and translators working would just simply carry it over as Omri. And it becomes anglicized as Omri. You never ever get a clue. Comri. And I'm accentuating it. And nobody really knows how it was originally pronounced. So Comri puts the capital at Samaria. In the King James, he's Omri. You have to wait until these very digs that we've been talking about. And I could have told you this flat out, but it's not my style. I think you ought to see things for yourself and see why the conclusion that I've come to it. In fact, one of the things, as I told you about Mel Terry's studies of and reporting on the revival in Indonesia, was the failure to distinguish between verifiable or corroborative witness testimony, and some one lone lady saying she saw somebody walk across a river on the water. Common sense tells you to distinguish between primary and secondary sources, and between those that can be corroborated from many witnesses and many sources, and one highly questionable interpretive source. And there have been many people in religious communication that have totally alienated themselves from the field of scholarship because of their pontifical declarations, like, many scientists say, well, who? Oh, the world of scholarship has long since abandoned this. Which scholarship? The ones that said Homer was not history? So I've led you laboriously down a path, night after night, repetitive on many things, to show that any conclusions firmly drawn are not based on one or two flimsy sources. We pulled out of our bags here one night the translations that are very recent of the various styles or inscriptions of the Assyrian reigns, of Tiglath-Pileser, Sargon, Sennacherib, people that are biblical personalities. We find to a man the reason why we can't find Israel in their territory is the Assyrians gave them an Assyrian name. They called them Beth-Krumri, House of Omri, if we use the King James name. Because that Omri, the sixth king, put the capital in Samaria, and for the first time, the Bible will agree, the land formerly called Israel, also called Ephraim, occupied by the house of Joseph, came to be known as Samaria. And that geographic designation carries down to the modern day. The Samaritans of New Testament times were transplanted from somewhere else in the Assyrian kingdom. And the people that represented the 10 tribes were transplanted out of the region that came to be known as Samaria, that the Assyrians designated as the House of Omri, the sixth king being the basis of naming it. And as Judah sometimes was called the House of David, they called Ephraim, the house of Israel, Samaria, Beth-Kumri. Well, Beth-Kumri is encountered over and over again. And the Camarii and the Gamera and the Camera and the Camarians and the Samarians all represent the tracking of the same name through various languages and dialects. All this is recently unearthed, did not even come forth to be seen until the digs we've been reading about in Nineveh and Nimrod and in Assyria begin to unearth The cuneiform we've just looked at had to be deciphered. The translations began to be worked out. The meanings and verifications heard. And the scientists began to tackle what to them were priorities and shove minority items to the side, such as frontier post reports from commanders sending reports on their frontier occupations. Very small reports, tedious details, the equivalent of captain's logs, but not quite as detailed or colorful, of some lonely outpost guarding a section of the Cumri or the Sumerian or Gomera. And as those some relatively small percentage remote outpost shreds and pieces and fragments of cuneiform and other kinds of writings begin to be looked at after the major breakthroughs have been examined, we suddenly find that which is of little interest to a usual archaeologist that has no interest in trying to figure out what happened to the 10 tribes. We find that we can trace them by a new name: Sumerians, Cimmerians, Cimmeroi, Sakasini. They are encountered by the Greeks. They are called Thracians, Sumerians, Scythians. The Greeks, being given the godlike authority over history from the German Greco-Roman view of everything, if they name somebody something, that's what they are. Well, that would be like sticking to what Columbus first called America, because he put a name on it that was erroneous. He thought he found something that he didn't find. Most of the languages of ancient tribes prior to the digs we've been talking about and the uncovering of Celtic archaeology, Assyrian archaeology, Hittite archaeology, Babylonian archaeology, until the uncovering of these other civilization sources in which there could be a synthesizing of the sources on the other side, the conquering side, for example, of those who conquered the Bible, where the Bible records the defeat side of the 10 tribes being carried away. Then and only then do we begin to find that what we've been calling people is what the Greeks called them. That doesn't necessarily mean that's what they called themselves. That doesn't mean that's what they called or were called by the Assyrians. If the only record you got of the Thracians is what Herodotus calls them, that gets on first base in history and begins to dominate all out of proportion. And Scythians, which is a description of a lifestyle that Herodotus commended because they carried all their belongings in a wagon and were tied to nowhere. Herodotus said the best way to live suddenly becomes a racial or a tribal distinction. No, it isn't. It's a lifestyle designation with a Greek word. It's like Mesopotamia or Padan Aram. Padan just simply means field or plain. The plain of somewhere. Padan Aram. Told you it was a synonym of Haran. You don't have to go very far if you realize that Padan means plain. Padan Aram. Padan Haram. You're not very far from the plain of Haran. Now, when you're working with words like this, that you got to find multiple cross-references with to figure out what ZTWD finally is identified to, you can understand what a wealth of knowledge has suddenly sprung up since 1800. By the way, since the excesses and major errors and over-interpretive ridiculous claims of the British Israelites were made. We're now not dealing with esoteric areas of conjecture. We're not dealing with one man's claim of some divine revelation through an angel and golden tablets like the Mormon's identity of a lost tribe. We're dealing with stones that cry out, and a wealth of information never available, and it is now possible to define the same people called by different names depending upon who's naming them. Israel's called the House of Israel. Umri puts the capital in Samaria, and it comes to be called Samaria. The Assyrians conquer them and carry them into bondage and write on their inscriptions, they're the House of Krumri. We begin to find out from those sources that possibly an error is being perpetuated in the English spelling of the king that is the sixth king of Israel, because we need to have K-H-O-M-R-I, the spelling, instead of O-M-R-I, as a little clue of the knowledge of the language. You'd never guess, looking at the word spelled with the Greek alpha, gamma, you'd never get from that so-called parallel between A and G that you got to put an H in front of it without the little reverse apostrophe over the A that gives you the clue that wasn't there in the earliest versions of writing the language down. We're way past language into cuneiform script. So we now know who the Sumerians are. We now know who the Qumri are. We now know who the Cimri are. We now know who the Kimri are. And we know that the Sumerians tended to form into a nucleus of many tribes that were the Thracians, that broke down into two strong tribes, the Jetai and the Moesi, on the west side of the Black Sea. And we know that in order to distinguish the two sections of the tribes, both of whom represent migrations of the ten tribes out of their captivity among the Assyrians, the Scythians came to be distinguished from the Sumerians as nomads in a particular area, when the word originally just meant all the tribes moving about in the area. And we know that the Celts is a language classification of all those nomads who, beginning in the 7th century B.C., started moving north and west through Europe out of that heartland area just north of the Caucasus and north of the Black Sea and around to the west of the Black Sea. And that's exactly the place that it is now clear that the Sumerians and the Scythians and the Sakasini being traced to the sons of Isaac, the Sumerians being traced to Beth Qumri or the Kimri or the Qumri or the sons of Omri, the sixth king of Israel, which is the name given to them by the Assyrians. And the Scythians just describes their lifestyle. And the Celts simply identifies them with a nomadic group that moved out with a unified culture of iron battle axe, battle wagon style, and a characteristic of language that began to split into diverse tongues, all coming from the same place, and they dominated the area north of the Caucasus, north of the Black Sea, at the exact same time in history when the other side of the coin tells us those ten tribes known as Sumerians, known as Scythians, known as Sakasini, known as Qumri, moved out of the area north of the Caucasus and around the Black Sea. There we have them. And there is little question in my mind, and there's nobody going to be able to prove the contrary. You have to make choices of probability. I know that Scythian doesn't designate a race, it designates a lifestyle. Nomad. I know the source of Sumerians. It's the Kimri that are clearly identified as the House of Israel, the House of Omri, carried into bondage by the Assyrians. The frontier post tells of an attack on Lydia, of a settlement, the frontier post writings and fragments finally being deciphered. Tells of a colonial settlement in Sakasini and Bactria that lets them go up both sides of the Caspian Sea. They attack Lydia, go across the Dardanelles and become known as Sumerians on the west side of the Black Sea. It's all happening at the same time, 7th century. And we have Esdras saying they moved out having taken counsel among themselves when invited to return to the Holy Land. They took counsel among themselves, and in a year and a half, a vast movement of them went through the mountains to the headwaters of the Euphrates and passed out to a land beyond, to Ar-Sereth, which simply translates city or hill of Sereth. We can locate that on the map today. Now, I'd like to just quit leaving that dangling. If you're not convinced, give me an alternative or find one for yourself. Those 10 tribes moved in the following manner. I'll give you a little map. Just hold steady. In fact, I'm tempted to have this map, or one like it, with some stuff I'd like to add, blown up. See this little map? Now, I don't know if you can get any closer over here. Come over to this area. Right in here is where the settlement of the Sakasini was. They moved out through the Darius Pass in the Caucasus Mountains. The group of Camara that the frontier posts say moved over this direction and literally attacked the Lydians, moved on around the Black Sea and up into this area here. You ought to try to do something in a mirror. I got to work backwards. The Sumerians tended to settle along the Black Sea, and the Scythians began to settle up into this area, though the Scythians only later was designated, as the Sumerians began to have the name dropped, and these were called Thracians. Now I can pick up, as I have before, a non-religious archaeological book, Thrace and the Thracians, another major area of breakthrough in recent archaeological excavations in Bulgaria. And here is the map I've shown you many times of the tribes called the Thracians by the Greeks, the shaded area. Here's your Black Sea, the Dardanelles through here, Troy right there. Here's the peninsula of Greece, the shaded area. And the tribes are, here is Bessi, Moishi, Jetai. I can trace those names. Moishi is pretty easy. All of these tribes, the Thracians, were characterized by Herodotus as worshiping Zalmoxes, a god who tricked them into believing in immortality. According to Herodotus, the Greek historian, who has a strange story he tells to explain how this god Zalmoxes, which simply means chief Moses or leader Moses, tricked them into believing in immortality. Now, there are some people that believe because that Joshua and Judges were written before Kings and Chronicles, and because the Kings and Chronicles record the happenings of their carrying into bondage, that when they went into bondage, they carried with themselves a Bible that included Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth, so on, 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, and all the writings of the prophets. They carried with them Hosea and Jeremiah and Ezekiel. No, they didn't. In fact, it was some of their own hireling prophets of the 10 tribes to the north that the kings of Assyria, when they saw the transplanted people settled in the area beginning to give them problems, they took some of the hireling priests that were in the line of those that were hired by Jeroboam when the tribes broke off, not of the descendants of Levi or Aaron, and brought them back to teach them the ways of their original faith, which is what causes the Samaritans of Jesus' day to claim a heritage and a worship of the God of Abraham. But it is known to this day that the Samaritans who keep their temple and worship on Mount Gerizim, up near the modern city of Nablus, that represent transplanted foreigners settled in the vacated territory when the Assyrians took the 10 tribes into bondage, taught by reprobate priests brought back to teach them, that were the reprobate priests that shared the idolatry with the worship of Jehovah that brought the downfall of the 10 tribes to the north. They had with them the basis of what even today is a separate Pentateuch. Those who are doing the translation work on the Old Testament will reference the difference between the Samaritan Pentateuch and the Judaic Pentateuch. These books of Kings and Chronicles and other similar records were put together after the return of the Jews from Babylon. So we have a people that are carried into bondage to whom the strongest memory would be Moses, who led them in the Exodus out of Egypt, who are now in bondage and will remember again. The people in bondage in Babylon had Daniel, who from the books, namely Jeremiah, was able to see the source of hope and promise, and not only was keeping that in front of them, put it in front of Cyrus the king. But the 10 tribes carried into bondage were a motley bunch. One of the characteristics of the Celts is they, I guess the cruelest term to use, is headhunters. They would form cups out of the skulls of the people that they conquered. They engaged in individual hand-to-hand combat of the nature of David versus Goliath. And they would cut the heads off of the individual. When they went to battle, you didn't have usually hosts of armies rushing at each other. They engaged, they'd go forth and call the champion of the other side forth to individual hand-to-hand combat. And their belief in afterlife was such that they were fearless of death and would go to battle stark naked with nothing but sword or spear and shield in hand-to-hand individual combat. And when they bested their opponent, they took his head. Well, whoop-de-doo. What did David do to Goliath? I can give you a passage in the Kings where they took heads like headhunters. Don't look on these tribes as refined, cultural, highly advanced, theological, pure people. According to God, as I read last night in Ezekiel, they had learned to commit their idolatry in Egypt. They went down as the sons of Jacob, and they weren't much then. They were willing to sell their brother into slavery and lie to their dad saying he was slain, and except for one of the brothers, they would have killed him. They were a motley bunch. They were 275 years in Egypt before they ever went into bondage. And God's word clearly says in Ezekiel 23, they went bad in Egypt. And you only have to watch them, as I said last night, in their treatment of Moses when God brings them forth. And for 40 years in the wilderness, those under 20 years of age were taught and trained and disciplined by God and Moses. But it didn't take them very long when Joshua brought them in the promised land to go bad again. Ahab, the worst king, was married to Jezebel, the daughter of the Phoenician king. And the marriage between the queen and the king married the religions until the worship of Jehovah was side by side with the worship of Ashtoreth and Baal. God condemns them for human sacrifice, another trait of the Celts. They didn't have to learn that after they went into bondage. They were already doing it in Israel, which is why God let them fall into bondage. One of the problems of the Jews looking for the lost tribes is they look for people they won't be ashamed of. But in bondage, they would remember Moses. They weren't a united kingdom. You read from Jeroboam's day until they go into bondage. They're fighting amongst themselves. The Celts have a characteristic of an ideal for the king, but a king that is not necessarily king because of heredity. They got a land in Ireland to pick one case before that pattern is set up. How many of you know they cast lots for Saul? Huh? You remember that? He had a quasi-election in addition to what God did with him. Now some of you are going to tear your Bible up to find that. I had one the other night. Just say, I know that Terah died before Abram left Haran. Yeah? Well, the Bible says Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. And you can read the genealogies and know that it says how old Terah was when Abram was born. And you add 75 years to it. And Terah, and the Bible tells you how old Terah was when he died. And there's a 60-year differentiation. He still had 60 years to go when Abram left him. There are little details that are important in God's book. Now, the Israelites were not a united group. They fought among themselves through the judges. You find constant lamenting because one tribe's busy doing this when another tribe's in a battle. Dan is bawled out because she abode in her ships when God needed them all there. You find the picture of tribal chieftains coming together through judges. And a man good enough and powerful enough, a Samson, a Gideon, a Jephthah, can unite them and rule over them in a loose confederation. But they're still fighting for each other. They had their own territories assigned to them. From this border to that border, and from this border to that border. They were each told to conquer the territory that was their lot. Many of them never did it. It was a loose confederacy of tribes with a king, a constant succession of bad ones that was carried into bondage. So don't be surprised when they finally leave their bondage area, with one bunch settling as Sakasini, another in Bactria, some moving across to try to attack Lydia, as the Assyrian Empire starts to come apart, that when they reappear north of the Caucasus, you have the same nomadic, Exodus-type existence without a Moses to rule over them because he's been deified, and strong tribal chieftains, each carving out their territory and only coming together against a united foe. Now, will you get that picture in your mind as they move across Europe? The tie-in is God knows where descendants of every one of these tribes are. He knows where they all are. And the mess I got to unravel will blow your mind, but we'll unravel it. I'll give you a little close-up of where you can trace these tribes in a map. So don't get hung up on Ireland alone. The reason we're going to get hung up on Ireland and hung up on England and hung up on Scotland is because we got to trace something else. The kingly line. You see, God didn't just promise that he would bring the tribes back. He promised a certain kind of happening to the tribes, and he made a promise to David about his kingdom. We've got to get these tribes to a place where a descendant of Judah and a descendant of David can come to a throne over them, or God has failed his promise. We got these tribes certainly scattered. We got them, not my people, not having obtained mercy, so lost from history until the year 1800, when they began to dig up the names given them by people, nations long buried. They weren't even known to history. They were called by names such as Scythians, Nomads, Celts, Thracians, Sumerians, and a lot of other names, including Tuatha De Danann and Miletians. And that's what we're coming to right now. That's review, folks. That brings you up to tying together. We have located traits in Ireland, Scotland, and England. Now we got to get into Ireland and start doing with the little baiting and dangling leads that we found there, what we've done to tie together the Scythians, the Nomads, the Sumerians, the Beth Cumri, the Thracians, the Celts. Now again, I asked the question, asked at midnight last night, do I have to beat that one to death, or can we leave it? You're never going to convince somebody about anything. But I am satisfied that the tribes that were so-called lost were never lost to God, were not even lost to history. They were just falsely named and not recognized for what they are, which is exactly what God prophesied. They would be known as not my people, rather than a people of God. I am convinced that in the tribes of Scythians, the Nomads, Celts, Sumerians, Thracians, Cumri, Cimri, we encounter the loosely federated, sometimes fighting amongst themselves, worshippers of Zalmoxes, 10 so-called lost tribes of Israel. But we still got to somehow connect Jeremiah, who is the trustee to build and plant the kingship over these people that have lost it. There's a promise not here that says there'll be many days without a king, and their Lord shall go before them. We've got to somehow find the connection between the promises to Jeremiah the trustee and the promises to David that are to be perpetual. Where in their scattering does David's line connect with them? Where's Zerah? I told you the story about the guy that said, my dad's story about the guy that he didn't know either. I haven't yet had a chance to go through this little book with you about the Celts. Probably one of the fullest study of the origins of the Celtic kingdoms, their institutions and ways of life, their religion and mythology, their confrontation with Christianity, the development of the various Celtic kingdoms, the origins, I've already said, the Celts in Europe, the origin of the Celts. And you know what you end up with? By this wondrous and brilliant group of people, this Nora Chadwick, professor of Anglo-Saxon in the University of Cambridge. Most of her life was spent doing research mainly into the Celts. You know what you end up with in this book? Where do Celts come from? She don't know. She just knows they appeared. Just appeared. 7th century B.C., north of the Caucasus Mountains, north of the Black Sea. Now, I ask the question again. I mean, we can beat something to death and never get to the pyramid, never get the eels figured out, never get to Atlantis, never undangle Zara, never get to read to you Tia Tefai's record of her trip, never unravel the trusteeship of Jeremiah. Where's Jeremiah buried? Anybody know? Anybody ever been to the Holy Land, found his grave? We know all about his birth. We know God sanctified him in the womb before he's born. We know just about as much about Jeremiah as any prophet we know. He is the trustee of both kingdoms in God's plans to tear them down, build them up, plant them, build them up. Where was he buried? Anybody know? Anybody ever heard of where his grave is? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar recognized him. How many prophets were recognized by a conquering king and told he could do what he wanted to do? If Nebuchadnezzar recognized him, he was something else. Where was he buried? Did that puzzle you? Sure does me. I want to know where the old guy laid down. How many of you know they've never ever nominated a grave for Elijah? That puzzles me why the people that want to disprove the Bible don't go find his grave. I mean, you dig up Elijah's bones, you got yourself a real find. As famous as Moses was, doesn't it ever intrigue you? They never found nobody anywhere. There is absolutely nobody that ever said, I know where Moses' grave was. You find Moses' graves, you got yourself a doozy of a find too. Yet you find a wife of Jacob's grave that was dumb enough to hand a handmaiden off to him. A woman that dumb shouldn't have her grave remembered anywhere. You women agree with that? Of course, I'm telling you, if you were married to Jacob, you might pawn him off on anybody. No grave for Elijah. Come think of it, there isn't one for Enoch either. No grave for Moses. Jude tells us Michael wrestled with Satan for his body and hid it away. In Jesus' day, everybody wondered where Jeremiah went in the Holy Land. Do you really think that anybody would have suggested that Jesus was Jeremiah? If they knew where his grave was? Or Elijah? If they didn't know where his grave was. Doesn't that bother you? I mean, by bother, I mean, I think it's very important. You can't find Jeremiah's grave anywhere in the Holy Land or Egypt. He was an important guy. Where'd he go? Where'd those king's daughters go? Where's Zara? I'm going to get these Celts and these tribes, among other places, to Ireland. Now here is the great authority on the Celts. Alternate translation, by the way, Celts. Nora Chadwick, professor of Anglo-Saxon at the University of Cambridge. Most of her life spent doing research mainly into the Celts. Many books, appointment in many universities in the British Isles, many degrees conferred upon her, university lecturer in early history and culture of the British Isles in the University of Cambridge from 1950 to 58, lectured in the universities of London, Edinburgh, Wales, Oxford, and Durham. 65, she lectured to the British Academy on the colonization of Brittany from Celtic Britain. On, on, on. No British Israelite. Understand that. It is difficult to pinpoint the origins of a people either in space or in time. How's that for a nice academic disqualification before you start? For throughout the story of man, there are certain threads of continuity. These threads reach backwards through millennia of the preliterate past in such a manner that significant transitions are rarely perceptible. And then only after those transitions have been accomplished. It is also difficult to define concisely what is meant by Celt or Celtic. Okay? That's a great, brilliant start. Did you learn anything from that? You learned that we got a tough job. You don't know that, but now you're in real trouble. To the Greek and Latin writers of the second half of the first millennium B.C., that's from 500 B.C. downward. Well, hoop-de-doo, that's when they started writing. I mean, you're not going to find the Greek and Roman writers writing in the... You're not going to be able to say they knew them in the 7th century because they didn't write in the 7th century. A profound discovery here. Herodotus, the father, quote, of classical history, discovered the Celts in the 5th century, second half. To the Greek and Latin writers of the second half of the first millennium B.C., the Celts were recognized as a cultural entity occupying part of Europe. Why do scholars have to go into all this business like first millennium B.C.? I think there's a secret urge to be a preacher on everybody, particularly a prophecy preacher. They like the word millennium. Were as many people preaching on prophecy before I started? Everywhere I turn on TV, everybody's in prophecy. I think what it proves, and I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to dangle that. There's one thing I haven't been copied on. Ezekiel 23. Hosea 1. To the Greek and Latin writers of the second half of the first millennium B.C., the Celts were recognizable as a cultural entity occupying part of Europe. I haven't learned a thing yet. The words Celtoi or Galli, Gauls, the name used by the Romans, presumably required no explanation. Again, we have a people being named by a people who saw them. Why were the Indians named Indians? Until now, we have to distinguish, if we're going to talk in international terms, between the Indians of India and the Indians of America. Because some dummy thought he landed in India, named Columbus. The Romans called them Celtoi or Gauls. The Greeks called them Thracians, Sumerians, Scythians, and all history ever since thinks that somebody somewhere was created by God and thwack, God said, thou shalt be a Scythian forevermore. Well, they were Israelites first, children of Abraham prior to that, descendants of Shem prior to that, and descendants of Noah prior to that. Why don't we call them Noahites? I'll show you something interesting. No, that's not the one. Show you something interesting. I think this is interesting. You interested in this? The Hittites. You know, they're new. Far as history is concerned, they've never existed. But as they begin to finally uncover the treaties, I told you about the Battle of Kadesh, where Ramses of Egypt was defeated. Ramses married a daughter, Hattusilus, the king of the Hittites. A deliberate act of statesmanship by the conqueror of Egypt. He's going to put his daughter down there, producing the sons on the Egyptian throne. The entrance of the Hittite princes into Egypt was immortalized on a stele found near Abu Simbel. The bride who assumed the name Maat Nefruri, truth is the beauty of Re, Maat Nefruri, I guess, is shown beside Ramses and her father on this inscription, Hattusilus III, a Hittite king that before the 1900s nobody even knew the kingdom existed, much less, I mean as an empire, much less of this stature. One of the accompanying inscriptions has recently been translated by Siegfried Schott. In his introduction, however, it's really Scott, I guess, S-C-H-O-T-T, but no Scott should spell his name with an H. The dummy, you ought to get that straightened out. In his introduction, however, this scholar uncritically accepts the Egyptian claims that have been subsequently corrected by the digs in the Anatolian plateau of Turkey. But here's the translation. It was reported to His Majesty, behold what the great prince of Hatti, that's the Hittites, does. He is bringing his eldest daughter with innumerable gifts. They cover the place where they are with their treasures. The prince's daughter and the princes of Hatti bear them. They are crossing many mountains and harsh passes and will soon reach the borders of Your Majesty. Send out an army and noblemen to receive them. By the way, how many of you remember when old Jacob left Laban and took Rebekah, his wife, that she hid some little household gods in her baggage? Remember that? The Bible? Remember that? You remember that? It took these recent archaeological digs of the Hittites to learn that a custom of the Hittite kingdom, those little so-called gods, though they were that, were the same thing under the laws of that country as the title deed to their possessions. As you have a deed on a piece of property and you thereby can claim it, those little household gods with the inscriptions on them represented the title of ownership to all the possessions of the household. So old crafty Rachel, who knew her old man had tricked her into sharing Jacob's bed with her sister Leah, and Leah got there first, she steals the old man's title deed to all his possessions. You suppose old conniving Jacob saw something else in her when he first met her? Took the Hittite digs to uncover that. Now, just think about the sons and grandsons and the stories that Grandma would tell them. You know, there might be some grandson out there that would say, hey, wait a minute. Even though my granddad and grandma buried these things, what if he knew where they buried him? But he certainly has an entrance into the kingdom of Laban's descendants. Just thought I'd dangle that there for a minute. Well, anyway, here we go. The prince's daughter and the princes of Hatti bear them. They'll cross many mountains and harsh passes and will soon reach the border of your majesty. Send out an army and noblemen to receive them. The king or pharaoh appears to be taken by surprise. It is, of course, highly unlikely that the king of Hatti would set out with his daughter without having paved the way. But these lines do seem to imply that the marriage took place on Hittite initiative. His majesty was overjoyed. The lord of the palace was glad. When he heard of this extraordinary event, whose like was not known before in Egypt, he sent an army and nobles to receive them at once. What is more, Ramses constructed, the Egyptian pharaoh constructed a prayer. Listen close. A prayer to the god of the foreigners. Now, as he addressed his prayer to the god of the Hittites, here is the prayer. No question, he was praying to the god of the Hittites. Here is the prayer. Nobody knew about this till after 1930. Cease making rain. His bride's on the way. Don't rain on her. Cease making rain and storms and snow, he prayed. And here's the name of the god, Father Seth, granted all he asked. You know who Seth is, don't you? Abel and Cain. Cain kills Abel, then Seth. The line of Seth is traced through Enoch, Methuselah, to Noah, through Shem. Jeff. Now, why, pray tell me, would a totally heathen, aboriginal, Hittite kingdom, if that's what they were, have a well-known worship so established that the pharaoh would make a god to the god of his conquerors, Father Seth? A habit pattern of deifying the patriarchs, deifying the predecessors among their patriarchal and prophetic or priestly leaders, which comes out in the Celtic habit of doing the same, which has caused modern people who study the Celts to call the Tuatha De Danann legendary gods, which caused the Vikings to think that Odin was just a legendary god. I'll tell you this much. Stick around a while and I'll trace Odin to the chief of a tribe in history who led the way, leading his tribe through northwest Europe from somewhere just north of the Caucasus Mountains. That's now fact. You've watched me read you about Schliemann. Until Schliemann dug at Troy, Homer was ridiculed as legend. Nobody's done the digging sufficient to make the same scientist and the same historians who are typified by the ostrich. Their ass is front and head is buried. Oh, Lord, that slipped out. God, forgive me! The Celts are the Sumerians, the Scythians, the Thracians, the Getae, the Moesi, the Sakasuni, the Beth Cumri. They are the tribes of Israel. I'm saying it now, no dangling. And I'm showing you on what flimsy ground anybody has if they want to say, can't be. Don't tell me when this kind of scholar can't tell me a thing about them. You say, how are you so sure? Same reason Schliemann was sure about Troy. I know that they have to not be lost because the Bible says that. They only have to be known as not my people, not having obtained mercy, and be scattered. That I know. And And since the Scripture says that, I have to find a people who are God's people in lineage, scattered, growing to a multitude as the sea, or rather as the sand of the sea and the stars of the heavens, who are scattered and don't know their heritage, and who have the characteristic and thus the name of not being known by my name, but rather not my people, not having obtained mercy. I know exactly where they went. They went into that area where exactly where the Celts emerged. Now this scholar says, the Romans used the name, presumably requiring no explanation. In more recent times, expressions such as the Celtic fringe have been used freely without the necessity of explaining that the term applies to the Celts of Brittany, Britain, and Ireland. These latter are the Celts, something of whose culture, languages, law, and social institutions have survived into modern times. They would seem to be, that's a typical academician's statement, they would seem to be the inheritors of a Celtic way of life which originated in the prehistoric past. Now we've got to find these Celts in a place where David's seed can get on the throne. I'm not dangling now, I'm being direct. If for the present this premise may be accepted, that the origins of the Celts belong to the prehistoric past. I agree with that. They're descendants of Adam. And Abraham. The corollary must follow that there can be no literary evidence to document their origins and formative phases. Zilch. That means the historians aren't worth shooting. Bang. Dead. Down they go. There appears to be no historically acceptable remnant of any possible oral tradition which might have been incorporated at a later time in the earliest surviving literature of the Celts. Bang. Kill the rest of the historians that just talk about it. It is necessary, therefore, to examine archaeological evidence. Hooray, it's what we've been doing. This may and does provide data of value. Hoop-de-doo. But they are concerned essentially with the material aspects of life. Well, I just read a wedding speech. Occasionally, some archaeological evidence allows hypotheses relevant to intangibles, such as social organization, religious belief, to be offered, but these must remain no more than hypotheses. That's fine. It's good enough for me. I mean, evolution sure has gone a long ways on a hypothesis. The belief that mankind exists sure has gone for a long ways on a hypothesis. In this context, the Celts emerge as one of the important peoples of Europe during the first millennium B.C. Well, that's what she said in the first line. We find them in the first millennium, and she says, "What? Well, you know what all that says? We don't know where they came from. We've got to look to archaeology for our only clue." Okay, let's do that. To anticipate, it may be accepted that this is one of the world's experts. To anticipate, it may be accepted that the Celts had emerged by 500 B.C. as a recognizable people in Central Europe. I thought that's what we said back here that the Greeks did. All right, that's marvelous. This is really great. She spends three more pages to say to the prehistoric people in Europe. Okay, we knew that. Then two new groups of people have showed up. Bell beaker folks, that drink out of beakers. And how do they know they didn't have spittoons? Then she says there remain some doubts as to the origins of the beaker folk. Okay, I ain't interested in that at this point. Let's get to the Celts. The second group is characterized by a perforated battle axe of stone. The common form of burial is named, and all evidence points toward an origin for this burial practice. Where is this origin? In the steppe lands of southern Russia, between the Caucasus and the Carpathian Mountains, directly north of the Black Sea. Now we're getting somewhere. Who landed there that had some culture, that came out of an area that had iron and followed those burial practices? The movement of the battle axe people has an additional significance, not only for the origins of the Celts. Some reservations must remain in any attempt at identifying the preliterate forerunner of a historically attested language with an archaeological culture. Yet there are cogent arguments based on the study of both philology and archaeology for suggesting that the initial spread of the Indo-European group of languages may be attributed to the battle axe folk, Celts. The peoples not only penetrated Central Europe, but spread over wide areas of the continent. The Indo-European group of languages embraces most of those current and present-day Europe, including modern Celtic language, as well as ancient Celtic, Greek, and Latin, ancient languages beyond Europe, such as Hittite. A couple over there look cross-eyed at that. I'm trying to tell you, I know exactly where we've been, and if you take the Bible, you can put it together. Just as you can only put the archaeology of Greece and Troy together if you make Homer not a fable, but with a historic base. You're only going to put the biblical people together when you use the Bible. Four gobbledygook. Whereas the Urn, that's three pages to talk about the Urnfield people. Urnfield people, Urnfield culture. Main difference between them, they bury people different. They cremate their dead. And here come these people, the Celts, who bury their dead with their wagons, with their armament, a practice, and the wagons are characteristic of them. So the Urnfield people cremate the dead. That's all you need to know at this point. The Aborigines of Europe. Now, whereas the Urnfield people may be justifiably considered to have been Proto-Celtic, there's that name again, Proto, the original, Aborigines. We are Americans. The American Indians were the Proto-Americans, by that definition. Whereas the Urnfield people may be justifiably considered to have been Proto-Celtic, their descendants in Central Europe, she chooses the word descendant, yet everybody knows they're descendants. How do you descend from people living in Europe when you come from the north of the Black Sea? Unless you mean descend on them. Their descendants on them would be better. In Central Europe, the people of the Hallstatt culture, two digs, Hallstatt and Latine, were the forerunners of the much digging that followed. And as the Assyrian culture comes to the surface, and as the culture of Babylon comes to the surface, and as the Hittite culture comes to the surface, Hallstatt and Latine begin to suddenly reveal the truth of a people displaced from the south of the Caucasus mountain regions in their culture, who originate in the north of the Caucasus mountain regions, whose culture is dug up at Hallstatt and Latine, Austria and Switzerland. A fully Celtic culture. The Hallstatt culture and its successor, that of Latine, together represent archaeologically the iron-using prehistoric peoples of Central, Western, and temporarily at least some other parts of Europe. These are the Celtoi, the Galli, the Galatii, the Galati of classical writers. The two cultures are named respectively after the sites at which they were found. Got modern archaeologists calling a culture a Hallstatt culture because they dig them up there. Small wonder that the Assyrians would call the Israelites Kumri because they conquer them at the city built by Kumri. Nothing mysterious about it. In very general terms, the Hallstatt culture in Central Europe existed approximately 700 to 500 B.C. Isn't that interesting? Most finds appear to date from the 7th century B.C. Parallels, well, he's talking about what's found in the burials. They don't bury horses with them, but they bury the harness and the bits and the riding instruments because they were master horsemen. By the way, the Hittites, they've uncovered the first records of training of horses. Now, parallels to this burying of the horse gear and parallel to this horse gear in type may be identified in the steppes of southern Russia, particularly in a culture. Now, she knows nothing, not a word in here about the lost tribes, no recognition of the biblical promises or the carrying away of the lost tribes, and absolutely no grip or grasp at all on the Assyrian frontier post fragments that identify who the Sumerians are. But we know from other sources the Sumerians appear north of the Caucasus. Listen to her. Parallels of this horse gear may be identified in the steppes of southern Russia, particularly in a culture which may convincingly be identified with that of the Sumerians, Cimmerians, who at a slightly earlier date appear to have been pushed westward by the Scythians. The Scythians, that was the name of all the tribes, because they were nomads, appear eventually to be separated in the language of the Greeks and the Romans, the Sumerians being those tribes in Thracia and Bulgaria of modern time, the Scythians being the tribes between the Black Sea and the Caspian, but all the same. Some of them went around up the Dardanelles, some came up through the Caucasus. Same people. And to distinguish those settlements of the Scythians that formerly was an abstract designation of wandering tribes, the ones that settled in that area for a short time, about 100 to 150 years, came to be known as the nation of Scythia in the designations of the Greek and Roman world. They were the same people. It's like talking of Asher and Dan. It's like talking of Zebulun and Naphtali. It's like talking of Simeon, who was south of Judah, and Asher, who was north, or Ephraim, who was north. They're the same people. Further support for derivation, because the Scythians were located more eastward than the Sumerians. You'd narrow it down like county to city, and city to block. In Galati, here are the tribes, if you want to really get delicate, in Galati, Ambracia, Aquileia, Augustodunum, Basiutes, Delphi, Drunamitan, Intramont, Glanum, Gloring, Gundestrup, Hallstatt, Hunneberg, Ischlanden, Holzerlingen, Kermaria, Latine, Larens, on through 35 they've been able to locate by the digs. So if they locate a name designating Scythians in one area, they break them like states. They're the same people. She recognized they all come from the same place. Further support for a derivation from southern Russia is provided by the adoption by early Hallstatt chieftains of wagon burial. You know what all this is saying? All this is saying is the Celts came from the exact same place that the lost tribes went under a new name, as Scythians, that describes their behavior pattern, Sumerians, which is the Assyrian carried through transliteration, Beth Qumri, and it's the same people in successive waves continuing to move without a land, looking for the place that God promised to plant them. She's saying the same thing over and over again. They came out of steppes of southern Russia. Knowledge of iron working and the arrival of horsemen from the east. That's the Celts. Descendants of the late Urnfield chieftains appear to have been receptive to the example of the newcomers. That's all speculation. The newcomers took over. Earliest Hallstatt burials dating from 7th century B.C. are found in the upper Danube region, in upper Austria and Bavaria, in Bohemia. It may be supposed that in this area the culture emerged. During the 6th century, let me read the other though here. This therefore may answer the question implied at the beginning of this chapter as to when and where the historic Celts originated. We're going to get it, folks. The most distinctive burials are those which contained a four-wheeled wagon on which the dead person was placed. Animals were not buried, but harness and functional and decorative fittings, including horse bits, were. In addition, there were other grave goods. The whole funerary deposit was enclosed in a wooden burial chamber, which may have been set in the ground, covered by a mound or both. Well, she doesn't say why that gives us a clue. I'll tell you why. Because that's the way the Greeks found the Sumerians and the Thracians and these Scythians burying their dead. During the 6th century, the center of power appears to have moved westwards into the upper Rhine area, southwestern Germany, Switzerland, and Burgundy. An outstanding burial from Burgundy is that of Vix, near Châtillon-sur-Seine in the Côte d'Or. The burial was that of a young woman of about 30, found lying on a bier, originally forming part of a four-wheeled wagon or funerary car, the wheels of which had been removed and placed against the eastern wall of the wooden burial chamber. The burial is interesting on two counts. First, it provides archaeological evidence complementary to the literary evidence of the existence of Boudica in Britain and the legendary Mave of Ireland, which appear to show that women were accorded parity with men in aristocratic society. Although the Greeks regarded the Celts as barbarians, they weren't adverse to taking advantage of the markets offered. Trade between the Greek world and the Celts passed through Greek colonies on the northern shore of the Mediterranean. An important colony was Massalia, modern Marseille, founded at about 600 B.C. Archaeological evidence consistently supports the hypothesis that one of the principal exports, if not the principal export, to the Celts was wine. Where'd they develop their taste for wine? This is shown, for example, in the many finds of characteristic Massaliote pottery vessels for the transport of wine found in southern Gaul, far north in the upper Danube. It is easy to document archaeologically the content of Celtic trade to the classical world. Salt. Oh, we're going, don't need to go through all that. Here's an important line. In general, for years until Hallstatt, I'll tell you now, are you tuning in on, I've already covered Nineveh, Babylon, Hittite,
Ebla, the discovery of a whole empire of Hittites nobody knew existed. Troy, non-existent until the 1800s. One guy, even after Schliemann digs it up, says that Homer's Troy is some dramatic parable on the movement of the waves and the sea and the winds. Legend. The Celts are only being discovered archaeologically in recent time. The digs at Hallstatt and Latini and the rest of them, wait till I tell you what the Russians have been digging up. That's later. These barbarians, why were they barbarians? Because the Greeks and Romans called them barbarians.
This expert says, in general, the technological level of the Latine Celts was equal to and in some matters surpassed that of the Romans. They weren't barbarians. They were just different. They cut heads off. Well, that barbarian, but so did the 10 tribes of Israel, so did King Solomon, so did King David. I mean, I just walked through a museum in Kansas City. I mean, look at it. Next time you go to St. Peter's in Rome, look at the great pictures of David dragging Saul's bloody head, big as a bull's head. I mean, Goliath's bloody head, big as a bull's head. They cut people's heads off. They offered human sacrifice. Well, God condemned the children of Israel for doing that. I read it last night. Their own children as human sacrifice. So if they're barbarian, they're barbarian for traits they had when they were God's chosen people. Volatile and undisciplined. Well, they were always that. Whose sense of loyalty, powerful though it might have been, was normally centered on an individual rather than on an institution. Before the Romans were able to conquer the greater part of Celtic-dominated areas of continental Europe, the Celts during the Latine period, which began around 500 B.C., 650 B.C., took them about 150 years to move northwestward. Only took a generation and a half, maybe one, for them to begin to dominate the areas of Austria, Bohemia, and Switzerland. Began around 500 B.C., and then achieved their most widespread expansion. They spread into and beyond areas previously dominated by their predecessors, the Urnfield cultures. They burst their way forcibly into Greek and Roman history, sacking, conquering and sacking, among other centers, Rome, about 390 B.C., Delphi, around 279 B.C., There is evidence that some Celts, at least, were seeking land for settlement, as is shown by the Galatii, who were allowed to settle in the vicinity of modern Ankara, and who, as the Galatians of the New Testament, and as late as the 4th century A.D., appear to have survived as a recognizable cultural group, even to the extent of retaining as their second language one which appears to have been recognizably Celtic. It was to the Celts, a settlement of 20,000 of the lost tribes, that Paul wrote the Galatian letter. Christians among them, to be sure. Was Jesus just filling in space when he said he'd come for the lost tribes? And he told some of his people on one occasion to go to him? In Italy,
As far south as Sicily, there is evidence of Celtic raiding parties. For the north in Italy, however, the Celts appear to have been more concerned with fighting for land to settle. Archaeological evidence has been recovered in the destruction levels of some Etruscan cities. The modern place names of Bohemia and Bologna preserve linguistically some evidence of the Celtic tribe of the Boii, part of which migrated from Central Europe across the Alps to settle in northern Italy. When the Romans finally conquered northern Italy, eventually to incorporate it within their growing empire as the province of Gallia Cisalpina, Cisalpine Gaul, as it comes to be known, the name itself acknowledged the strength and durability of the earlier Celtic penetration and settlement. Before the Latinic culture of the Celts was finally destroyed by Roman conquest and culture, some of its elements had penetrated beyond the continent of Europe into Britain, listen, and Ireland. Ireland remained untouched by Roman arms and largely unaffected by Roman civilization. Upland areas of Britain in the west and the north also preserved a little of Celtic culture, sufficient at least for them to experience something of a minor renaissance of what remained of that culture after the collapse of Roman military and civil control at the end of the 4th and the beginning of the 5th centuries A.D. In chapter 3 of this book, there is some discussion of the archaeological evidence for the penetration of these islands by the Celts. I got a whole book of it right here. Don't need chapter 3. Ambiguous though some of it may be at present to her, it must be emphasized that only, listen close, only in the context of Britain and Ireland. Now some of you are going to say, well, why didn't you be this definite a long time ago? Because if I had, you'd have written me off, some of you, as a British Israelite, and wouldn't listen long enough for me to lay the evidence down. You would have been blinded. I'm still not a British Israelite. Don't go boxing me up yet. I'm an Israelitish Celtic right now. I know that the Celts, the Sumerians, the Scythians, the Thracians, the Getae, the Moaxi, and these Celts that came out of that area were dominated, possibly intermingled with, what's new. They carried Phoenician genes in their body when they went into bondage. They carried Canaanitish genes in their body. The whole tribe started half Egyptian, the descendants of Joseph. The dominant force, the tribal arrangement, the combination of leadership between prophet and king was Israeli. Now listen. It must be emphasized that only in the context of Britain and Ireland may any attempt be made to correlate all the evidence for Celtic culture. Only one place in the world. I didn't say this. She did. Now, if there's any one thing I've proven, it's hard to get this gal to say anything for certain. Did you pick that up as I went along? I mean, you don't have to be a PhD to figure that out. She doesn't want to commit herself. We finally, on page 40, after 40 years in the wilderness and 40 days temptation, we finally get a commitment. She's got a little bit of waffling, ambiguous though some of it may be at present. That's a backdoor crack to sneak out. Ambiguous. See, I know these scholars. Ambiguous though some of it may be at present, it must be emphasized that only, how's that for a word? Only in the context of Britain and Ireland. They went everywhere. They sacked Rome. They sacked Delphi. They settled at Galatia. They penetrated as far as Sicily. They dominated Austria. They dominated Switzerland. They came out of the area where the tribes settled, but only in the context of Britain and Ireland. That's why I say too many Christians have thrown the baby out with the bathwater in reacting to British Israelite extremes. Only in the context of Britain and Ireland may any attempt, how's that for a no qualification statement, be made to correlate all the evidence for Celtic culture, archaeology, native tradition, literature, some few classical references, and the not unimportant survival of a Celtic way of life even into recent centuries. Then where do we have to go? To Ireland and Britain. It cannot be denied. I'm still reading. This is The Celts by Nora Chadwick, a Pelican original. That's what it says right there. It cannot be denied that the Celts emerged in history as one of the dominant cultural groups in Europe, perhaps the most important in Central and Western Europe. It is time, she says, that the contribution of prehistoric Europe, and more particularly that of the Celts and their forebears, who were they? Their forebears were the 10 tribes of Israel, was recognized. It is time that the contribution of prehistoric Europe, and more particularly that of the Celts and their forebears, was recognized adequately. I couldn't agree more. Can't hardly wait to get there. Ireland, an illustrated history. The archaeology of Ireland, the story of the Irish race that I've dabbled in and sort of mocked and baited you and dangled you. And I can't hardly wait. And I got to get over all of this to old St. Patrick. And where's Jeremiah's grave? Somebody said on January 26th, my note said, it's in Ireland. I never said it was there. I said, some people say it is. Now, I'm asking you the same question. I don't want to just stay in Ireland and England, because we got to figure out where the Milesians came from. We're going to go back to Troy, and we got to figure out who founded Troy, and why is Zara dangling out there, and where's Jeremiah gone from Egypt? And since the Milesians conquered the Tuatha De Danann and set up the High Kings of Ireland, we got to figure out what got them to the Iberian Peninsula and who they were. But right now, I am totally convinced the Celts are those lost tribes, dominated at least by those lost tribes, moving north and west. And I want to go to England and Ireland, where this expert says it's the only place you can correlate all the evidence. Now, I've baited you and I've dangled. How about it? Am I being straight enough tonight? Early Ireland and her people. Ireland, an illustrated history by John Ronelet. Legend holds that St. Patrick banished snakes from Ireland in the 5th century A.D. In fact, the reason why there are no snakes there is that blank, blank, blank. The first significant human remains in Ireland were found at Mount Sandal, County Londonderry. Little is known of these Mesolithic Middle Stone Age settlers. They probably came from Scotland and ultimately from Scandinavia. They were nomadic hunters. In the middle of the 4th millennium B.C., Neolithic, Late Stone Age farmers arrived in Ireland using polished stone tools. Okay, that's before the flood. They moved through the Balkans around 500 B.C. Okay. That settles them.
The earliest Irish passage graves date from about 2800 B.C. Okay. I'm not interested in them. After the Neolithic people, the next series of immigrants brought the Bronze Age to Ireland. The burial practices of the Bronze Age men are defined. They built impressive stone circles, not as big as Stonehenge, but impressive. Exactly when the Celts started coming to Ireland, and whether they came in peace or as conquerors is not clear. Two groups of Celts populated the British Isles, the Gaels and the Brythoni, or Brittoni, Brith being a Hebrew name for covenant. The Brythoni settled in Britain, Scotland. Many traveled from Britain as well as directly from the continent of Europe and settled in Ireland in large numbers. They brought with them the Iron Age, which had begun some 300 years earlier in Central and Eastern Europe. It is difficult to be certain at which point the Celts' iron culture superseded their proto-predecessors. But by 500 B.C., it's right here, 500 B.C., right here. Can you get it? Come on, get in there. Don't anybody think I'm making this up. Can you read that? But by 500 B.C., Ireland, hold still, I'll move this. Ireland was probably a completely Celtic country. Can you see that or not? By 500 B.C., Ireland was probably a completely Celtic country, enjoying the widespread use of iron implements. About 650 B.C., they appear. Early part of the 7th century B.C., north of the Caucasus. About 50 to 60 years earlier, they were carried into bondage and settled just south of the Caucasus. They bring the Iron Age culture north of the Caucasus. From 650, 150 years about, it takes them to cross the channel and settle in Ireland. You know, they probably weren't extra good at swimming. Isn't that interesting, those dates? The Celts themselves seem to have originally come from the lands. Oh, I've got to let you see this. I mean, I can't believe these archaeologists are so smart. Wait a minute. Right, this line here is the one I want. Right there. Go over to the front of it, though. Quit reading like a Hebrew. The Celts themselves seem to have originally come from the lands. Keep going. I've got to read. Lands around the... Now go back. Caspian Sea, migrating from there in stages in all directions. Is that what it says or not? The Celts themselves seem to have originally come from the lands around the Caspian Sea, migrating from there in stages in all directions. Sociologists and linguists today have even detected similarities. They go through the Celtic languages. First historical mention of the Celts dates from the 6th century B.C., when they're recorded as being in France and Spain. The historian Herodotus, writing in the 5th century B.C., placed them along the Danube and in the Pyrenees and described the Celts as one of two Western European peripheral peoples. Because of survival of Celtic language, particularly Gaelic, the Celts of Wales, Scotland, Ireland, and Brittany have always been aware of their forebears. Gaelic remained the dominant language in Ireland until the beginning of the 18th century, when English began to take over.
And it took the awful experience of the famines in the 1840s and 1850s, together with immigration and new educational policies, finally to bring the widespread use of the language to an end. From about the same time as Herodotus was writing his history, the earliest known written evidence of Ireland and its people has come to us from a Carthaginian sailor, Hamilco, who went on a voyage of exploration and discovery along the western coast of Europe. Having sailed through the Pillars of Hercules, the Straits of Gibraltar, he ventured northwards up the coast of Spain to the Bay of Biscay and beyond. He encountered Celts sailing at high speed in coracles of skins sewn together. From the description given, they were made in almost exactly the same way as Aran Islanders still make theirs. And he learned of the Sacred Island, or so the ancients called it. This lies amid the waves, abounding in verdure, and the race of the Hierni dwell there widespread. By the time the Greek geographer Strabo, a contemporary of Julius and Augustus Caesar in the first century, wrote about Gaelic Ireland, much more was conjectured. The first, I repeat, was the Carthaginian sailor Hamilco. Would you like to know what he had to say? He walked right into that. He walked right into that. Some other time. I got you to Ireland, didn't I? I got you there. Some of you look at me, disgusted enough, you'd like to shake me.